Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. March is Women's History Month, and on What's Next, we have had the opportunity to speak with many incredible women making an impact across Western New York and beyond. Over the next few weeks, we will revisit some of those important conversations. This week, we begin with Sharon Sanford, founder of the Sadie Strong Project. Sharon, who also goes by Sadie, is a breast cancer survivor who started the project to promote early detection, healthy living, and empowerment for women affected by breast cancer.
A lot of folks will probably relate in some sense to your journey, right? There's been a lot of folks who've been impacted by cancer, whether it's their own diagnosis or in their family or friends or loved ones. And so I'm going to just start with you and your own personal journey. So can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got to this point?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you mentioned that when you get a diagnosis and you don't have a family history of breast cancer, you don't realize how cancer impacts so many people around you. So I had a routine mammogram when I turned 50. I had been getting mammograms every year since I was 40. Mm-hmm. I figured if you have insurance,
right,
that's the first thing. You should definitely always get mammograms as well as doctor's appointments in general. And even if you don't, there's support out there for you. So I got a routine mammogram and it came back that I had breast cancer that spread to my lymph nodes. Mm. Ductal carcinoma was the terminology. And so when I received the phone call, it was just shocking. You know, so I was diagnosed on a Friday and I didn't get the call until Monday. So I had to sit on this that there's a problem, mm-hmm. you know, over the whole weekend. And then when I got the call, I was shocked. So you're hearing this woman on the other side of the phone and it kind of sounds like Charlie Brown's teacher. So you hear you have cancer. And then everything else kind of like fades away and you're stuck in your own mind. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it started for me. And so I knew that I had to tell my husband. So that was the first thing I did. And he said, this is what he said. Well, the first thing I said was, God help me, because mm-hmm. I know that, you know, God has to be my first option and not like my last resort.
Right.
And so then I called him from downstairs and said, yes, you know, I've been diagnosed. And so he said, we have to go to grandmother's and pray right now.
Wow.
So that became the center point. And that started this whole process. When I got to my grandmother's house, my father was there and he said, Sadie, because that's what my family calls me, mm-hmm. Sadie. He said, Jesus is on the boat. Mm. And so what that means is when you're going through a storm in your life, you have to have a foundation. And ours is Christ, mm-hmm. right? And so he said that. And then the next pivotal moment was when my sister circle gave the mantra, you've been assigned this mountain to show others that it can be moved. So I realized that while this diagnosis was pretty scary, no one in my family had ever been diagnosed with breast cancer. I didn't think I knew anyone who had breast cancer. It was something, a battle that at that point I realized it was bigger than me.
Right.
So right. That's how the journey started for me.
Yeah. And so, you know, you discuss like hearing that diagnosis in the moment and then life obviously changing directly after that phone call. And so when you think about, you mentioned like not having family who have gone through that, right? Like, where did you draw strength and awareness from after that diagnosis?
It really was from my grandmother.
Okay.
My grandmother, Emma, she had battled not cancer, but a health challenge. Mm-hmm. And really the doctor said, we're going to give her a morphine drip to keep her comfortable. Right. Because basically she was at that time, she was 89 years old.
Okay.
And so I watched her fight. And all along, I believed that my grandmother was going home. I believed in her healing. And it was that faith that showed me then that God is a healer.
Right.
And so if God healed grandmother through that, I know he could heal me.
Absolutely. And so you talk a lot about faith, right? And
yes,
that being the center of your beliefs and how you move forward. And so you describe yourself as an ordinary woman connected to an extraordinary God. And so what does that phrase mean to you today?
It means that there's so many people that walk this earth that you realize that you can't do anything alone, that there has to be a greater power that walks with you, walks before you, that helps guide you through challenges and triumphs. And so just how God could use someone like me. Mm. One of the things that my father said to me, additionally, he says, Sadie, you're going to be a spokesperson for breast cancer awareness, right? I hadn't even talked to a doctor at that point.
Okay.
And so I'm looking at Dad like, okay, Daddy, yeah, I will, you know. But when you have people in your life that speak life words, you know, and not, it's what you focus on in your life that helps you to make it through challenging times. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a regular person that God has used to do some things that might be able to impact and touch people in a positive way.
Yeah. And I love that because I think, you know, when you think about cancer, and before we started, I shared with you, I have family members who are navigating this journey now. And I think about the circle of support, right? And the importance of that. And so when you think about your own journey, where have you drawn support from?
It's been from everyone who loves me. And when you go through something like this, you realize the impact that you've had on other people. My grandmother told me this. She says, you know, you've always planted good seeds.
Okay.
You know, so you plant and build relationships with people in a positive way. You carry yourself in a certain way, then people will draw to you. During that time, one of the reasons why I started the nonprofit organization Sadie Strong is during my healing journey, I received so much love and support from so many people that I knew that you would expect, you know, your family, your loved ones, your best friends, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But then it was other people that you didn't expect, you know, and I had to make a choice early on. How am I going to share this information?
Okay.
Once I received it, right? Am I going to keep it to myself and just deal with it and work with it? Or am I going to share, right? And so when I was first diagnosed, I was going through a process with my organization and I didn't want to dim the experience for others. So I kept what I was going through to myself for a while to that group. After we finished that process, I shared with them what I had been going through during that time because I was diagnosed the day before we were starting this process.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, I don't want to shift how their experience, because I wanted it to be great and positive. And when that was over and I was able to share, hey, this is what I've been going through, one of the women that I was dealing with, and let me tell you how amazing this is. She was a breast cancer survivor that I didn't know. We had been working hand in hand, you know, for months, right? And come to find out, she had the same doctor that I had. And then I realized at that point, I needed to share this with other people because you don't realize when the statistics say 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in her lifetime. And if you don't realize that the people around you may be affected as well, you could be helping someone and encouraging someone on the way.
Right.
And so from that point, it was like, I have to share my story. And when I started to share my story, I started getting such positive feedback from people. The woman that I talked about, her name is Stephanie. Stephanie on my first day of chemotherapy, she came in and brought me this bag that had a blanket and snacks and bracelets and motivational rocks. And that was the first gift that I received that started me saying, I'm going to do Sadie Strong love boxes. Because from that gift, I received a card almost every day. I know the mailman was like, what is going on? People sent me cards every day. My son's basketball team, they brought over a basket. Like, I received so much love during that time that it was like, I can make this. So right. on a day that I might feel like down, then the doorbell would ring and someone would be coming or someone would call. It made the journey a lot better.
Right.
With the people that I had around me that was really stepping up to support.
I love that. And I want to jump into talking about Sadie Strong, right? And so obviously you've gone through this as a personal journey that you're navigating, but what was the first step that made you decide, okay, I want to start this project, and tell us a little bit about what it is.
Okay. Well, during my healing journey, and that's what I call it. I call it a healing journey because I believed early on that God was going to heal me.
Okay.
I don't understand the terminology of remission and all that. I didn't want those terms. I wanted healing.
Right.
Like, I wanted, it is done.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what I was drawing on. And so during my healing journey, every morning I would spend time in my dining room. That was my time with God. I would listen to music, and I had large notepads, you know, the sticky pads that you hang on the wall when you're doing workshops. And I would have those on my dining room, and I would write down scriptures because I'm wondering, like, Lord, I know you have me here for a reason, and what is it that I'm supposed to do with this? Mm-hmm. And so it started off with t-shirts. So I said, okay, we're going to have collective prayer, right? And so the t-shirt said, we believe God.
Okay.
So that's how it started. A bright neon pink shirt, and it said, we believe God. And my brother would call and check on me all the time. And he said, Sadie, you're the strongest person that I know. And he would send me these the strength emojis. And so, you know, I'm working through and I'm jotting on my little pad, and it came Sadie Strong, right? And understanding what women are going through, it evolved from there. So it started as t-shirts, and I said, okay, wear this, and we're going to have collective prayer because together we believe God for my healing.
Right.
Right. And on the 1 year anniversary of my diagnosis, I started Sadie Strong to take away the pain that that first phone call gave. And so now on October 30th, which is the anniversary of Sadie Strong, it means something different than that diagnosis.
That's great. And I think, you know, the trust that you have that this was going to be a healing journey for you, and the mind frame that that looks like, I think is really important as well, right? Because not only is it a physical, you know, journey that you're navigating, it's also mental, right? And a lot of people talk about the mental journey that it takes on you as well. So can you just talk a little bit about your mental journey through this process? What was that like? And what is that like?
Because it is.
Right.
It's a continuous journey.
Yeah.
During the time when I was going through my healing journey, I felt like I had to be strong for everybody else.
Okay.
And in hindsight, I don't know if that was the best for me mentally, right? Because I knew that my husband and I, we have three sons. One of our sons lived out of town in Florida at the time by himself. And I felt like I had to be strong for everybody. If I broke down, then everybody's going to break down. If I didn't have faith, then everyone else would be shaky and wavery. So I felt at that time, my friends, if I cried, they're going to cry. Mm-hmm. So I had to do a lot of when I had those moments, which you do, like there's like I'm talking now with all of the positive and the bubbly things about it, that the and the faith. But there are times when you wonder, like, why me? Mm-hmm. What why am I going through this? And this doesn't feel good.
Right.
You know, what does this really mean? And so during those times, you know, I would be by myself and I would cry. You know, I would cry in the shower, in the tub, you know, when I'm by myself. And then I would release what I had to feel. And then I would put the smile back on my face and go back out and start another day. And but to this day, when I hear of a woman that's diagnosed, or if I hear of a woman who passes away, or a woman, and now I'm hearing younger and younger women who are diagnosed, it just makes me feel a way. And I've had two doctor's appointments that we need to go back and look a little bit more and do more testing. And emotionally, this is tough because once upon a time, I would have never even thought about anything like that. Right. But now there's always, even though you know I'm healed,
right,
that there's always that chance.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I shared with you before, I have an aunt who is navigating triple negative breast cancer. And we understand that more African-American women are navigating that. And we have late detection. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that we face as a community as well. And so I know you talk about in your organization, like helping women in early detection and support through that journey. So what does that look like?
It's really about us as Black women, women in general, mm-hmm. knowing our family history. We know that a lot of times our families have kept things secret. And it's the same way, like even when I was going through my healing journey, there were some women that were going through, whether it's radiation or chemo, mm-hmm. and they hadn't shared with their families. And I'm like, wow, how, why? You know, like, but it's their prerogative,
right.
You know, they had people handle things differently. But, you know, I just like I understood that early detection really gives you a better chance at survival. Like it could be treated mm-hmm. if we catch it early. And a lot of times with us, we weren't doing that. And so I thought that, you know, one, we're going to promote that.
Mm-hmm.
Get your testing. Know your family history. Know your body. Like, we should know how our body feels when it's normal.
Mm-hmm.
So if something abnormal happens and we're regularly checking it, we'll say, hey, this isn't right. And then we have to learn how to advocate for ourselves. Because if we're not able to get a mammogram until we're 40 and you feel something and you're 32,
mm-hmm.
you have to be able to fight for yourself to get the testing that you need.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so that's exactly what my doctor told me, right? Knowing that there's a family history and making sure that you're doing early detection as well. So I was able to go get my first mammogram before 40. I'm not 40 yet, but those are conversations that a lot of people are also nervous about, right? And I can't tell you how many stories I heard about, oh my gosh, a mammogram, it's the worst thing ever. And so can you just kind of talk through that process in itself? Because I know I was underwhelmed in terms of after going and I was like, oh, that's not even that big of a deal, right?
Look, it is. There is a feeling about it,
right?
But I don't think it's any worse than getting your eyebrows waxed,
right?
Or pulling an eyelash off,
right,
or some
right.
of the things that we do. And when you think about your health, I know I've talked to women like, well, I'd rather not know. Yeah, that's not a great answer,
right?
Because
right.
it's better to know and to get the treatment that you need, because medicine has evolved
right.
so much now. One of the fears that people said, I don't want to lose my hair. I don't want to. Yeah, you know, that's a part of it. But on the other side,
right.
your mane can grow back thicker and more beautiful.
Right.
So it's us talking to women about the importance of it,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, and providing them with the education behind it.
I do have a question. It's funny because as y'all were talking about this, I was texting my mom because I had some questions, because ironically enough, my cousin right now is going through. She has been diagnosed with stage 2.2.
Mm-hmm.
She actually has her last treatment today and then she's going for surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, because my mother had lung cancer. She just got done with her chemo. How do you, or how was your children able to like stay as strong seeing, you know, you go through what you went through? Because I know when I seen my mom go with what she went through, and like now as I see my cousin, because she posts on her Instagram, like every time she goes through this, and me seeing her go through this is really like hitting home. So like, how was your sons able to continue to kind of be as strong?
It's something, because each person, and it's funny, I did a blog when someone you love gets breast cancer, because when there's a cancer diagnosis in your family, it impacts everybody.
Yeah.
It's not just your diagnosis. It's everybody's diagnosis that's connected to you, that loves you. And so in true, each of my sons, we have three sons, each of them have different personalities, right? And they handle things differently. And each of them handled it in their own way. And but the underlying thread was helplessness. You know, they wanted to help, but they didn't know how. So but what they did is they did it in their own way. So my oldest son, he became strengthened and he just drew closer to me with everything. So he became my right-hand person for Sadie Strong. He became the guy to help create this organization to make it into what it is. My middle son is more emotional like I am. So his was more introvert and around me more. You know, I want to be near you. My youngest son was in high school at the time. And his first thing is, well, I'm going to get some pink sneakers. So he had to play, you know, so all of his important games that year, he wore those sneakers because they were, you know, they were there. So it was that, and they would watch me, you know, I found them staring a little bit more, but it drew us really as a family all closer. When my hair first started coming out, so I started chemo in December, right? And I was hoping, I'm like, well, my hair's not going to come out because I went through two treatments and my hair didn't start to come out. But right around Christmas, and we're very holiday focused family.
Yeah.
So we got, the family was all in town at holiday, and my husband's looking at me. He's like, your hair is doing good. So what I did is I cut it down short first because I used to have long hair. And so I did that first quick chop. And then around, you know, Christmas Eve, we do this tradition, and my husband's looking at me on Christmas morning. He says, you're looking, it's doing good. It's hanging in there. But the night before, I realized my hair was coming out. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to tell them because I didn't want to ruin Christmas. So when he said that to me Christmas morning, I pulled a plug of hair out and I said, it's not. And I cried and I left and, you know, went upstairs. Mm-hmm. And so now it left everybody in this panic kind of scenario. Like, what do we do? And that was what I was trying to avoid early on. Remember, right. I told you that.
Yeah.
And so I go upstairs and I cry, you know, and I got myself together. And then my husband got them together. And my mom and my brother were in town and he says, come on, we're going to cut mom's hair. And so each of them took a time cutting my hair to bald. Mm. So it happened that day on Christmas morning and my sons each took a turn cutting my hair, and it made me feel more connected and more loved and more beautiful with my little bald head. And so they came together in their own way, and I knew that they loved and supported me, and it was something that was different and special.
Yeah. And I love that question from Charles, because when you think about the family dynamics and drawing strength from that, I can think, you know, in my mother's journey and my aunt's journey and what that looked like for us all to be there. Right. And similarly, you know, we went and shot for wigs. Right. And made that like a fun thing that we were navigating. But it definitely is something that, you know, touches you in that way, because we have so much just interest in hair and our looks, especially as a community as well. And so I know when we first started talking, you talked about advocacy, right? And many women or many people who are even navigating a cancer diagnosis, you hear that, you talked about like kind of the Charlie Brown after you hear that first diagnosis. But the next thing that happens after that for a lot of people is they kind of get like, I don't know, maybe stiff or maybe not being able to move forward in a certain way or even understanding how to advocate for themselves. And so can you chat a little bit more about what advocacy looked like for you and then the women that you work with through Sadie Strong? What has that looked like for them as well?
So for me, the blessing in this, I have a sorority sister who is a physician. And so I called her right away and I talked her through the diagnosis and asked, what does this mean? What does this terminology mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and who do I call next? You know, and so she gave me a list of places to go, a list of people, and she shared with me the timeline. Because, you know, when you get a diagnosis, you want to know right now. So what's, because people now are starting to, if you tell someone, they have a whole lot of questions
right.
for you that you don't have the answers to.
Yeah.
And so she was able to walk me through some of that. So it helped me identify the doctor. And of course, I made sure that I got a second opinion. Mm-hmm. So I went to two doctors. And it was in a short period of time. And then I didn't tell them about each other.
Okay.
So that was me. And so they gave me the same exact diagnosis. They gave me the same exact course of action. And so now it became, who do I go to? And it was next, now, how do you make me feel? Mm-hmm. So the surgeon that I chose made me feel more connected. Like it was, the other one was a little more industrial. I'll use that term.
Okay.
she felt more warm and connecting, like she wanted me to live.
Okay.
Both of them did.
Right.
But her way resonated with me. So it was the best decision that I ever made. And she connected me with the right doctors from that point on. And so when we start Sadie Strong, one of the things that we have incorporated is an Ask the Doctor workshop. Mm. And it's a community conversation about our health. And what it does is, and we've really tapped into a lot of African-American doctors, and they have talked about a variety of different topics. And advocacy is one of them. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you manage through when the doctor doesn't listen to you?
Yeah.
And one of the things is you find another doctor, right? And so we've been trying to create a network of physicians that have been successful and sharing that information with the women that we work with, giving them the education and providing them with resources. So as a part of that workshop, we also do a health and wellness expo that provides a variety of different resources that, because a healthy woman, a healthy mother creates healthy families. Mm-hmm. And so if we can provide them with the tools that they need to be able to advocate not only for themselves, but also for their families as well, then we'll have stronger families and stronger communities.
There's more of What's Next coming up after this brief message.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Next, we hear from dietitian and nutritionist Rachel Laster. She discussed the challenges of maintaining New Year's resolutions and stresses the importance of long-term manageable dietary changes.
You got a lot going on.
A lot. Busy lady, but I enjoy all the work.
Yeah. And it's important work.
It is important work. There's a lack of information around nutrition, mm-hmm. especially for our underrepresented communities. So it's important work and truly why I did become a dietitian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually never knew a nutritionist or a dietitian. Growing up, I didn't even know that job.
I was informed in 2012 that there were no African-American dietitians in Buffalo.
Wow.
So I was like, oh. And around 2015, I decided to go back to school to become one.
Yeah. And where'd you go?
Duval University to become a dietitian. My first degree is from a million years ago at RIT. I'm actually the first Black woman to receive a bioinformatics degree.
Okay, probably Black history.
In America, but wow. I can't prove America. I can prove RIT. I can't prove America, but just given the nature of the timing, mm-hmm. it's probably the case.
That's huge.
It's a thing.
Well, congrats.
Thank you.
That's huge. I didn't know that. You need to put out a t-shirt so people can know. So it's February.
Yes.
I feel like this is a time of year where people start to veer away from their New Year's resolutions. And I don't know anybody who doesn't have a resolution that involves getting healthier,
yes.
whether it's going to the gym, eating better, eating at home more.
Meditation, self-care.
Something that involves health.
And to your point, yes, it's people start falling off of their, if they chose to establish a better habit around something, this is often the time of year where they start to maybe fall off of those good habits. In regard to eating right, though, it's definitely, if you're trying to, you know, improve your health through food, it is good to maybe try to establish just a healthier diet. A lot of people do crash dieting, especially, you know, before the holidays or during the holidays or after the holidays, we want to assume these diets that are not necessarily the best laid plan. And it's best to assume a diet that is, you know, lifestyle management and mm-hmm. something that you can do long term as opposed to something that is super restrictive.
Yeah.
The New Year's resolutions often maybe put people on a path that isn't as sustainable as they would like. And so therefore, that's why they end up dropping the healthy habit they may have started. Now, if you're doing something simple as, you know, maybe eating more vegetables or just incorporating more fruit or doing something like drinking more water, those are fine things to adopt. But often people are adopting diets that are very restrictive in calories mm-hmm. or
completely cutting out carbohydrates or something like that. And those type of diets are not the best to follow, as once again, they're not sustainable long term in most cases and don't really give people the long term effects they want, but maybe some short term effects.
Yeah. What about intermittent fasting? Like, is that healthy? Is that a good...
Intermittent fasting, well, it's not bad, or there's a dearth of a lot of research around it, and there's all, well, there's research in aspects of it, and then there is some other research. So the research we have shows that there's almost no difference between just calorie restriction, regular diet calorie restriction, and intermittent fasting in outcome. However, often intermittent fasting can help people stick to their calorie restriction goals.
Okay.
So often if you're someone who is, you know, snacking at night, and if you make yourself stop eating at 7, then you stop doing even what we can consider maybe healthy snacks at night. Because if you have like, oh, just a little crackers and peanut butter and here's some carrots and here's some fruit, like you're just doing these things constantly, that adds up. You know, even healthy snacks will add up into calories. And so you could very well overeat. So it helps people stop doing maybe those small meals or little small snacks as frequently. And so then they will actually adhere to whatever calorie restriction they would probably need to be on.
Yeah. Because admittedly, so in my church, we fast every January.
Well, that's good.
So it helps me kick off the year strong. It's, you know, there's very strict times that you can eat. But then, like, by February when the fast is over, I'm, like, back to eating my sweet heat barbecue chips at night.
Well, to that point, well, like, people who are Muslim and practice Ramadan, you know, if they acknowledge their that holiday, you're not allowed to eat from what's sun up to sundown, correct?
Yeah.
And so that's pretty much just a textbook study of people doing intermittent fasting. And we have, you know, evidence that people will often overeat in both the times they're allowed to eat because of the nature of the fast. And so there's not as much overeating in the beginning part, but often at the evening part, the evening meal, people will overeat to compensate for the fact that they didn't eat all day. And and then often if there is weight loss during that time, we see people gain the weight back.
Gain the weight right.
Yeah. Ugh, fasting is not a bad idea. It's just, it can be a tool.
Yeah.
It can be a tool in your toolbox of things to lose weight, but really the best thing is to figure out firstly what you like to eat, how you like to eat, and then also like what your needs are and match your eating patterns to that as best you can. So because if you have a health condition or a chronic disease or something of that nature, you do have to watch what you're eating more so than someone who doesn't have those things.
Yeah.
And it's sort of important to make sure that you are understanding what your intake is. So I often, when I work with clientele, if they're not tracking what they're eating, I do ask they at least start it for about a week or so, or just try to see, and just do it in whatever method they think is most appropriate. If you need an app, go ahead. If you want to, you know, just write it down on a piece of paper, go ahead. But the best thing to do is to track it in some form or format for at least about a week, just so you can actually get a realistic idea of what you're eating. Because even like your intention can be, you know, you might think you're eating very well, you're not overeating, you're not undereating, you might think you're in a certain area, and you may be far off from where you think you are in terms of calorie intake. And as much as it's not as cut and dry as calories in, calories out in terms of weight loss and or weight gain, it sort of also is that basic.
Yeah.
But like I said, we have a lot of people who just think they're eating less. Like, I can't, it's me and myself, admittedly. I was like, oh, well, I'm not overeating. And I actually, you know, ran the numbers. And I was like, yes, I am. Like, because I eat, if you've seen my, like, Facebook page or whatever.
Yeah, you always have the best meal.
Like, I eat rather healthy meals. Yeah. But I would notice, like, I'll also don't post, like, at that point in time, I've cut myself off from as frequently doing this. But I used to go to, like, get, like, a cupcake or a cookie or have the, like something sweet, because I have a sweet tooth. I really do. And I would eat those things and not really count them in the way that, in the calorie amount that they really probably should have been counted in. And so I'm like, so as much as I didn't think I was overeating because I'm eating these really healthy meals, like, you know, all vegetables and salads and, you know, salmon and all these just good things, I was probably overeating in the sugar category a bit. It helps you be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And like, not that you're trying to be dishonest with yourself. It's just a matter of, it helps you be more honest and that, and just be aware of what your intake is. And then that helps me work with the clientele, if they are tracking, to, you know, see where they can make changes, what changes they are best for them to make. Because a lot of people as well may not know the amount of nutrients you need.
Yeah.
'Cause like for women, women need about 60 to 65 grams of protein a day. And that's pretty much through your lifespan after you're adult. You know, so and men need about 70 to 75 grams minimum. These are minimum amounts a day. And so I've had some clientele that will be eating all their calories, but maybe only eating 30 grams of protein a day.
Yeah.
So that's not sufficient. So it helps me help them understand like where they need to make changes, and also like help them understand, you know, where they need to make changes. So yeah. I can like relate information to them more appropriately. But I also noticed this also with our elderly community, because as you age, you need less of some things. Your protein needs for stay the same, but your want to eat deplenishes just from aging. Like your need right. to eat changes. So especially with our elderly members, we have to make sure that they're still trying to keep their protein up. And that's much more difficult if you're only eating two meals a day. You know, like older people, they'll be like, oh, I just had some tea and toast and I had, some soup. And I'm like, okay, that's not sufficient. you have to work with it. And so that's why often they have to drink those things like Ensure or something of that nature, because they need to meet those protein needs. That doesn't really change as much as you age, but like, so your need for water would go down as you age a little bit, your liquid needs, but that doesn't change. So since your protein needs don't change, we really need our elderly members to our elderly, you know, community members to be aware of that and understand that they need to, like, if they're going to be eating, that since their appetite has dwindled, that they should prioritize things that have protein in it. So, you know, meat, like if they must, canned tuna, you know, other types of seafood. We try to ask people to stay away from, you know, what traditionally more cultural dishes in as frequently, not at all, like, but as frequently, like, you know, African-American cultures, we have some dishes that are a little bit more caloric than other things.
Yeah, but they're the best ones.
No, they can be very delicious. and I'm a dietitian that likes to help people understand that all foods do fit.
Yeah.
It's just you have to consider volume and quantity and like frequency. So I like to work with people and have them understand that they can have these things. It's just they might want to consider how much of it they're having, like how often. Like Thanksgiving is a wonderful meal, but we shouldn't have Thanksgiving dinner 4 days in a row. Like that's not the greatest way to, you know, like have long-term effects of health. I very much am a fan of repurposing food. Mm-hmm. So for our CURLS, which is an organization here that was centered around helping women cancer survivors, I did a Thanksgiving like repurposing of leftovers webinar cooking class. So we took the sweet potato pie, we turned that into chickpea and sweet potato dish, or candied yams, and turned that into chickpea and sweet potato dish. We took the turkey and just made turkey salad because that was we took the collard greens and turned it to, if you're familiar with callaloo and saltfish, it's a common Caribbean dish. We did a collard green and saltfish type dish, and I also, you can't improve macaroni and cheese. Like you can't improve it health-wise, so just eat less. Like, it's delicious. Just eat it, enjoy it. And I did something else. I can't remember what it was. But we did, so I like to help people understand that they can take these leftovers and do maybe other things that may be a little healthier with it instead of just eating in a natural state.
Yeah.
Fried chicken is fried chicken. I can look, we can talk for hours and hours on the variances of food. However, fried chicken is good. Just don't eat a lot of it. Like, there's protein, there's too much fat if you consider the fat content, but we have a lot of people who are, you know, very, like, super interested in veganism or something these days, and they'll have a fried mushroom.
It's still
fried. Like, so the issue really is the frying, not the content. And if you are someone who maybe is a diabetic or an older person, like I said, we need that protein, and you're not going to find that protein in that mushroom.
Right.
Like, so while this is healthier in a way, it may not be healthier for your needs. And so it's really important to maybe either work with a dietitian or just understand what your needs are so that you can make those choices.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to pivot, but I have one question first.
Please go ahead.
Before we do, are there such thing as good sugars and bad sugars?
Not really. No. So all sugar is sugar. Now that's also like we're considering what are your conditions. So honey is not better than table sugar unless you are considering the antioxidant content.
Okay.
So if we're focusing on glucose, sugar is sugar. All sugar, like raw sugar, turbinado, brown, you know, like honey,
sugar.
Agave, all these like all these sugars are sugar. Your body's going to react to it the exact same way. It's going to break it all down to the exact same glucose. Now, there are benefits to honey in a way where it does provide antioxidants. So if that's what your goal is, you want some antioxidants with your sugar, go ahead. That's fine. It's really, you still want to watch the volume of sugar you're using. There's not, this one sugar is not going to be significantly better than another sugar. People are like, you know, I don't have that white table sugar. I just have, I like raw sugar.
Yeah.
It's sugar. Your body has no idea there was a difference. there's no difference. To that point of vegan desserts, I had a friend insist that this vegan cookie was significantly better than another cookie. And I was like, the problem with cookies is not the milk or the egg per se. It would be the sugar content. And so if we're going to have a villain in this situation, it would be the sugar content. And that usually doesn't change. Like Oreos are vegan. I wouldn't call Oreos particularly healthy. Delicious, yes, but not healthy. So you have to consider like what we're being marketed in terms of health and like the buzzwords people are using to make you purchase things that really won't be beneficial in the way you may think they would be.
So we know that Buffalo is really unique. You are very active in the community in like a lot of different ways. You're a part of a lot of different community groups, a lot of community facing work. So in 2022, we know that we had a mass shooting at Tops, the only grocery store in a black community in the city of Buffalo. And
very unfortunate.
It caused for a month the grocery store to shut down, which obviously was a lack of resources. I like to use food apartheid and not food desert because a lot of this is systemic and intentional.
Systemic and intentional, very much so, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I want to ask first how you felt about the efforts to provide the community, especially 14208, with like nutrition and like food resources post May 14th?
Yes. So I actually have to applaud all the organizations that did come together because the nature of that area, like you said, food desert, food apartheid, there is a big issue around that, especially in several areas of Buffalo, because if you aren't someone with the transportation to go to an area where you can get something better, this is where you have to shop.
So
in terms of the efforts put forth, and that was a lot of, you know, community different organizations like African Heritage Food Co-op, Feed Buffalo, and several others. If I did not mention you, do not charge it to my head and not my heart. There were so many organizations that did reach out and create an ecosystem over there that unfortunately was not getting the attention it deserved prior. So the food, the nature of food access in Buffalo isn't great. At least to healthy, what we call healthy foods, and I'm thinking in particular fresh produce. We have a lot of people here now doing the work. We have so many organizations that are doing the work to help improve that. Like we have, you know, Buffalo Go Green as well, the organization we mentioned earlier. Providence Farm Collective, MAP. There's so many organizations that are trying to help increase the need, the access to fruits and vegetables in Buffalo. So we have a lot of people doing that work, and that is good. So I'm glad that that work is happening. In regards to the shooting and the efforts afterwards, it did sort of, I think, elucidate for a lot of other individuals in the community, though, the need for education around eating healthier, as well as just the lack of access prior. Like, you know, unfortunately, our communities were very much ignored. And, you know, so since they were ignored, we had individuals of the mind to do the work prior. Like, you know, like they were trying to build a market. I love that Truly Rooted Market is where it is over on Fillmore now. That is a beautiful store, as well as Salud over on Main. Like, we have stores that are now much more in that area. And I think also maybe have potentially may have gotten funds for that. I have no idea exactly. But I think it helped show people the need for better access to these vegetables. Vegetables and fruit and, you know, produce in general, and healthy eating in a sense. We also have so many urban gardens. So those individuals help people learn to create their own food. Now, I have no green thumb. I tried. I gave up. Like, so I appreciate them for at least trying to teach and helping people, but also creating even more access. Because at the end of the day, as much as we do just shop at stores most of the time, we can learn to take care of ourselves in a way. And also, there are very few things I say globally as a dietitian that will improve your health. But the only two things I do say are drink more water and eat more vegetables. Yeah. And so since those are two things that I think are very important and can pretty much apply across the board, access to those things I feel is very important.
So for the people who may not still have access to those things regularly, whether that's because of the location they live in comparison to the closest real grocery store that has fresh produce, or finances, you know, we have a really high population now of people from other countries who may not be eligible for certain social services. What tips can you give people to try to eat more vegetables, drink more water, you know, make healthier choices when they don't necessarily have the same access?
Yes. Okay. Well, I mean, there are some food pantries that you can that are supported by, you know, Feed More or other organizations that can provide you with, you know, that have access to fresh fruit and vegetables. I know Harvest House would be one. Provisions 139, that's over on the west side. They would be some food pantries that you could attend, but if you don't have access to those, because once again, that's still a transportation issue, or at least where you are located issue often. So if you don't have money for food, I imagine you don't have a car. I'm assuming you may. I would say, like, there's ways to sort of stretch food. Canned food gets vilified, and it is very salty in comparison, but you can, like, the utilization of canned food, you can, like, rinse vegetables off. And then, like, if you rinse them, you can still use them in soups and things of that nature. If you have fresh fruit and vegetables, I would never throw anything away. What you should do is when you see it starting to maybe get less fun, just freeze it. Like just because you can turn it into soup. Soup is a very easily stretchable food. Our canned beans are a very good source of protein. Our canned vegetables are still a good source of fiber and minerals and all those things that vegetables provide. Just like I said, the preserving methods are salty. So we do ask that if you are using canned vegetables, to try to rinse them, like, before you utilize them. Frozen vegetables, people have asked me, like, are frozen vegetables as good as fresh? Sometimes they're better. You really don't know, because frozen vegetables often get picked and then frozen. So they retain that nutrient content. When we have our vegetables in store, we don't necessarily know how long they've been, like, how long, where they came from, how long they were in the truck, how long they got in the storage room, how long they've been out. So they could have essentially lost some more nutrients than your frozen vegetables. And frozen vegetables are often a very cost-efficient method of getting your nutrients in as well. So if you can't afford fresh, but we do, we have a lot of stores, we have a lot of efforts, a lot of community efforts to help provide people. I know Saturday Academies are doing the free farmers markets. So there's a lot of efforts around in Buffalo that I'm glad people can access. It's just maybe giving more education around where they are, make sure people know that they exist.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think one of the biggest issues when it comes to community awareness is just that when we're such a segregated community, unless you are located near the resource, you may not know it exists at all.
You may not know. And so there's probably some more work to be done on that effort to make sure that many years ago, I was like, there needs to be one person in charge of all this to disseminate this information so that people won't be working in silos and people won't be doing, like, at least the nutrition efforts, but to the nature of the work, unfortunately, it's very much grant-led in most cases. And I don't know how you're familiar with grants or not, but it can be, like, it's a lot of duplication of effort because of the nature of the way the work is paid for.
Right.
And so since there's, like, oh, this one person's doing this over here, but now it's cut off, and now someone else is over here doing this, and now that's cut off, and now someone over here is doing this. It's very similar, but now that's cut off. And so since the nature of it being grant-led and somewhat confusing, that also, I think, leads to why people may not be able to know that something's happening. Mm-hmm. But we, like I said, there we could do some better effort and maybe make sure that people are aware of the beneficial things to them in the right. community.
Are there any other myths about food and eating that you hear that just like grinds your gears when you hear it?
The water, the alkaline water. Like, you don't need that. Like, so I'm more of the, I do like to tell people to save money. Like, I'm very big on teaching recipes and doing community classes. And just when I do those classes, I try to give recipes that are firstly affordable and then lean people away from doing things that aren't to their benefit. So once again, like, you can pay more for water if you'd like, or you could just drink water. Like, there's not going to be any actual science that supports alkaline water being better for you. No shade to Dr. Sebi's diet. It's a perfectly fine diet. However, it is not accurate in the science behind why it would be a good diet. And it's much more restrictive than it needs to be, because some of the things he's saying don't eat, you can perfectly well eat and be fine. Mm-hmm. That's not how mucus works in your body. that's not conceptually how it works. But if you were to eat and follow that plan, you wouldn't probably find any particular issue with the diet. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not doing what he says it does.
We talk for days.
Yeah, huh? I could probably, like, prebiotics. If someone's, there's nothing wrong with it. Probiotics are a thing. I would suggest you just buy some yogurt. I wouldn't suggest you pay, like, unless you want to buy something more advanced and you actually know you have a diagnosed issue within your colon that requires more more of a pharmaceutical method of a probiotic, you're probably fine just eating something
but
like
that. But you can
yogurt.
Find a lot of things like, in yeah, food, right?
Yeah, you find a lot of things in food. So people talk about prebiotics now, which is just a fancy word for fiber. You don't need to purchase those. Like, so if you're seeing something marketing that to you, you don't need to buy that. You can just eat more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and then you will get more prebiotics in your diet. It's really just truly a fancy word for fiber. We don't need to do a lot of things. Anything that says like keto, just about on it, unless you are someone diabetic and in need of a lower carbohydrate item, you probably don't need to buy that. However, if you're someone that does want to increase their fiber intake, those breads and like those type of products are often higher in lower in carbohydrate and higher in fiber. So you have to look at your labels. Nutrition label reading is super important, and a lot of people just don't do it. And that's where your source of truth, in a sense, is going to be. Now, it can be off by about 20% in either direction legally. Mm-hmm. So, but in most cases, that's just for the sake of. And that's mostly the case of restaurants, because you know, if you're scooping food onto something, can't really measure that fully and know exactly what's in there. But in terms of what you're seeing in the market, that number and those things does have to be, that's regulated, you know, that in a sense. Like, so it's important to read your labels, because that'll give you what's in your food. And so it gives you that much more information. You know your protein content, you know your fat content is, and you know what your carbohydrate content will be, and protein. And all. So these things are all important to know, especially if you're trying to do that tracking, especially if you're trying to just do like to meet your needs. And that's important for people to do and know. To that point, I feel like there's some things I should say that people should know. So in terms of water intake, I've noticed that some people don't drink enough water. And this is a lot of people, not just some, like a lot of people don't drink the right amount of water. They drink some water and they're like, I've had this one 16 ounce bottle a day. That's not sufficient. You need a minimum 4 16-ounce bottles a day, mm-hmm. Unless you're, like I said, older. But so you need 64 ounces or so of water a day minimum. And then more than that's good. You don't necessarily need that gallon. Now, that's a lot. That's about two. That's okay. That's more than you would need. But I do like to help people, like to the point, drink more water, eat more vegetables. To that point as well. So we as dietitians support this thing called, propose like our government thing, My Plate. So we ask people to eat about half a plate of vegetables and fruits, non-starchy. So, and then about a quarter of their plate be carbohydrates. So rice, pasta, starchier vegetables like potatoes, corn, things of that nature. And 1/4 of our plate be protein. About any 3 to 4 ounce item of protein, mm-hmm. would be about 20 grams of protein. So we say, and by protein, we prefer lean proteins like chicken breast, turkey, just about any seafood. Seafoods are going to be a much lower fat way to get to the same protein goal, or protein amount than our meat sources. But if you can't eat any of those or choose not to eat any of those, you can always do things like beans, lentils, tofu, if you're interested in learning to cook that, because a lot of people aren't as familiar with tofu. But those are all plant-based sources of the same protein.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. I just learned so much. I've been doing it wrong, guys. I gotta go home and adjust. But I really appreciate having you, and I hope that we can have you back at some point, because I think these conversations are so crucial in our communities. Before we leave, for people who want your services, who want to learn more, who want to sit down and figure out what they need specifically, how can they find you?
They can find me at Real Life Dietetics. RealLifeDietConsulting.com or at they could just give me a call at 716-812-1577.
That would do it for this special episode of What's Next. In the coming weeks, we will continue highlighting powerful conversations with women who have joined us on the show. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.